Brave New World.
Hello and welcome to this week's Brave New World programme. Today we're going to be talking about something literally out of this world. Now, many listeners will know the American leadership has announced plans to introduce a US Space Force by 2020. In August, US Vice President Mike Pence outlined plans to create an elite corps of soldiers trained to fight in space and a space command that will design military strategies for warfare beyond the atmosphere. Now, does all of this bear more than a passing resemblance to science fiction literature, movies, and TV series by any chance? Joining the program to talk about this issue is Dr. Paul March Russell, a lecturer in comparative literature at the University of Kent and the editor of the International Review of Science Fiction. Welcome to the program, Dr. March Russell.
Thank you for inviting me. Great to be here.
Now, if I can ask you a sort of slightly abstract question, as somebody who's, I'm talking about myself, lived in Russia for a long time, I'm aware of the emphasis the Soviets made on the conquest of space, and it became a kind of object of national pride. Is it possible to draw parallels with the Cold War space race and this new situation to dominate, quote, space, although as yet the Russians have not announced their own space force?
Yeah, 2 points up. Yeah, it's not exact parallel, I don't think. There's a kind of lack of goals in comparison with the old Cold War space race. I mean, there it was initially about getting a satellite into space, followed by a living being, followed by a human person, and then, of course, onto the moon itself. And we don't really have those kind of goals as such. It's much more a kind of continuation of current terrestrial geopolitics sort of relocated into space. Mm-hmm. So in the ways in which we may be sort of protecting territories around the United States or around Russia or China. So we're doing similar things in orbit around the Earth as well.
Is it possible to say then that through the media, in one way or the other, the American public, particularly the American public, that's who we're talking about at the moment, is sort of being psychologically being prepared for the design, construction and maintenance of this so-called space force, which will clearly be very expensive?
Yeah, I mean, are they being prepared for the design? I think it's too early to say. There's certainly, you know, obviously the kind of core supporters of the Trump administration, I think, will be behind this idea. But even when you look at analysts who are just supportive of the idea, there's a lot of debate whether this is the best solution or the correct response. There's certainly questions around the budgeting of the proposal of the scheme. We also have to bear in mind, of course, we have the kind of, you know, the kind of military and cultural legacies of the invasion of Iraq. So whether or not the American public will fully buy into this idea or not, it's really too early to say. Obviously, we've not yet seen the wall between the United States and Mexico go up. So, you know, this may not actually fully realize and may become more compromised. General Mattis has kind of been ambivalent about the idea. He's behind it now, but he was against it previously. It might become a force within the current American military services. We just don't know at the moment. So it is still somewhat hypothetical, I think.
Yeah. And also, I mean, these things, although they've put a date to 2020, which seems to be rather ambitious to me, doesn't it? I mean, these things take a long time to develop. I mean, they take decades, don't they? I mean, it took America many years to gather the technology to go to the moon. It did the Soviets. It's not an overnight thing. But let's move on from that, please. As far as the idea of this program goes, what struck me as being quite unusual, and I think you pointed it out in a recent article, is that Mike Pence referred to the necessity of American dominance of space. Now, where's this come from? Does it have some sort of link with perhaps the idea of the need to make America great again? And is this also bound up with some nostalgic post-war kind of ideology? Or science fiction, perhaps?
I think there's two parts. I think in terms of kind of making America great again, obviously that's a, you know, kind of general rhetorical device used by the Trump administration, you know, before the president came into power. And so, yeah, certainly kind of it may well feed into that kind of general rhetorical strategy. And, you know, again, going back to your earlier question, it might well be persuasive. It may well bring people around. You know, it depends what kind of message is being sold here. To some extent, I feel it's a somewhat impoverished version of the message that underlaid the original Cold War space race, where I think it was very much more a kind of inspirational, much more about expanding in the solar system, maybe in the wider cosmos. It was a kind of something much more transcendent. I think at the moment it is primarily nostalgic, I think, as you say. And there's a kind of a sort of repository of mythical and ideological ideas that the imagination came up on. It is partially there within science fiction, some of the texts which I've mentioned a moment ago, but it's also there going back into, you know, into the 18th and 19th century history of America in terms of the frontier, in terms of westward expansion, the sense of a kind of untransacted destiny between the settlers and the land. I think, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia there, but also a lot of very influential ideas that can be drawn upon, I think.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And also there's this talk of this so-called manifest destiny, you know, that the Space Force will be a kind of groundbreaking endeavour for America and the final frontier, to quote Mike Pence again. Now, this really strikes me, if you take the word America out, of something straight out of Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely. I think I think it's important. I think there's a two-prong here. Obviously, when we say manifest destiny, we do mean something which is very American. Again, that kind of untransacted destiny between a settler and land that I mentioned a moment ago. But take the word America out, there is certainly, you know, a number of individuals thought to gain a foothold in space have all had a sense of destiny. I mean, you mentioned at the top of the interview about the sense of place that the Soviets put on space exploration. You can tell it very strongly. Example that was being back in the Russian Olympics a couple of years ago. You know, it was very, very noticeable the way in which space and cosmonauts were part of the imagery used in the opening ceremony there. So not just America, Russia, China will also have their own particular kinds of ideology, iconography, about colonization or space exploration. I think you find a lot of countries which are superpowers or would be superpowers, they do see space as a place in which they need to make a foothold. So yeah, there's kind of Star Trek-y, but also kind of, you know, other kind of indigenous, you know, science fiction's, fiction moves, Big Body Problem novels, very important in Chinese science fiction, elsewhere in the world. I mean, you can sort of see that, again, that ideology playing out, I think, in China, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, space really is the last frontier, of course, isn't it? I mean, it is the only frontier as yet sort of untainted with human wars. And I suppose Pence is right, but it's just not rather disturbing because nobody's sort of asking the question, well, is it my space or is it your space? I mean, is space kind of delineated into countries or continents, or how do you kind of, you know, say that this is our space?
Yeah, that's really the underlying issue here. Whether pro-America or pro-Russia or whatever, you know, whatever your national allegiances are. You know, the general issue about this is that, you know, space has for a long time been militarized. That we have there's a treaty from 1957, I believe, but that's now really outdated because a lot of the technology we're talking about now didn't even exist back in 50 years ago. So there's a real need to actually start thinking, okay, if it's militarized, if it's being militarized even further, depending on whoever the various countries are, then we have to think about, okay, how is that space going to be actually regulated? What kind of legal structures do we need to ensure that militarization carried out properly, as it were? There's no rollback on this. We can't demilitarize. It's happened already, as I say. So we do need to have legal structures. We do now have treaties to actually kind of regulate that process. And absolutely, you know, we've been talking about the ways in which different countries have different ideas of manifest destiny. And they're all going to feel they've got footholds in space. The moment you start getting sort of nationalistic in that sense, again, there's going to be tensions there, there's going to be fault lines there, these areas which need to be regulated by some kind of multilateral, multinational treaty, I think, you know, in order to avoid potential antagonisms in the future.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's take a break here.
Brave New World.
Welcome back to Brave New World program. Today we're talking about something completely out of this world. We're talking about the creation of the US Space Force and its resemblance to science fiction. I'm talking to Dr. Paul March Russell, the lecturer in comparative literature at the University of Kent and editor of the International Review of Science Fiction. I don't really want to get political about this because I think it's just so fun talking about current events in terms of science fiction. You know, I'd much rather talk about that. But in a way, though, I can't help thinking that, you know, the understanding that there is a unipolar world and that one country really dominates the world and it has responsibility to sort it all out and make everything okay, you know, that seems to be running into problems with the appearance of a multipolar world. And I'm just thinking that at the same time, simultaneously, we've got this new thing happening out there, which as yet is sort of doesn't belong to anybody particularly, you know, so we can do that one now instead, you know, and it's really good for public imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of general issue where I think science fiction comes actually really important. Science fiction has always had a long history of tackling, you know, social problems in the world, in the here and now. Science fiction is never really about deep space. It's never really about the far future. It's always about this world and the problems we have now. And again, I think if you were to look at, say, the novels of Ian MacDonald is writing a series of novels about the colonization of the moon and the ways in which the moon will be or could be exploited for raw materials, and then the kinds of colonial tension that emerges between different kind of financial and feudal dynasties. Again, it's a very internationalist series of novels that MacDonald's writing here. So what he's really exploring there is those tensions between nations and dynasties and financial corporations and how we exploit that base, as it were, that area for our own profit and gain. And indeed, what he's doing then, Donald, is raising a whole series of questions about how we should actually better go about this whole process. He's going to have to think about how he best do it. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the dystopian side of it is really quite disturbing, but there's also actually science fiction proposing scenarios in which we can overcome those problems and actually find ways of collaborating and working together for the greater good.
Now, I'm fascinated by the idea, and I'd like to discuss this idea with you, that in fact we underestimate the role of literature, and particularly of science fiction, in the determination not only of world politics, but actually things like inventions. You know, I mean, I'm thinking of Jules Verne, you know, before the submarine was invented and stuff like that, and in preparing people's minds and their psychology for the existence of a technology which doesn't exist. I'm thinking, you know, like things like iPads in 2001, Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, you know, and things like that. And suddenly in people's consciousness, there's a need for that. There's a vacuum has been created, which then people can come along with an invention and fill. Do you see this application now, this thing that's happening now? I'm sorry, it's a rather vague question. Do you see what's happening now as sort of creating a vacuum in people's brains? Okay, even there are problems in manifesting it, but people think, well, maybe there should be a space force. You know, we need Space Force, don't we? You know.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I think there's a debate about this. I mean, I think, as come back to the earlier point you made, you know, space has been militarized. There is, you know, from the point of view of America or from the point of view of Russia, there is a genuine military threat out there that needs some response. Whether that's Space Force, as it's kind of been outlined or sketched out by Mike Pence and others, I'm not really in a position to say. But certainly, if you come back to the area of actually ways in which science fiction can help in terms of imagining, yeah, certainly science fiction can be used as a way of preparing people for what might be becoming inevitabilities in terms of, you know, tensions in outer space. Science fiction becomes definitely a legitimate and a viable means of expressing, articulating fears and desires, and for people to actually work out quite rationally how best they're going to get around certain kinds of problems and things, again, for the greater good, you know, without the need for kind of war antagonism and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, science fiction classically is a kind of a literature of possibilities, and it prepares people for possibilities. And that really is one of the most, you know, vital and viable things that the medium can do.
Yeah. Do you think that some science fiction writers are being paid? I mean, I'm sorry for this very slanted question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you think that some science fiction writers are being remunerated because they are creating these new ideas, this new terminology and necessity for...
If you suggest them being remunerated by any political administration, I've got absolutely no evidence to suggest that at all. I mean, there's nothing which suggests that, so I can't really be drawn on that one. I mean, certainly when you go back to SDI in the 1980s, yeah, certainly, you know, people like Jay Parnell Larry Niven did have very quite close tie-ups with the Reagan administration on the SDI project. But whether anything like that's happening now, I've got absolutely no evidence to suggest that. You know, again, I think the discourse is quite general, and I think they're going to be setting up echoes and resonances with science fictional ideas, things that we've seen being rehearsed in previous decades. I can't really see anything more definite than those kind of echoes or analogues, as it were, at the moment. I don't think of any writers actually being employed, as it were, by any administration at the moment.
Okay. What about films? What about the recent stock of space films? There's almost no science fiction. It's just synonymous with space, isn't it? You know, we've got the new Alien films and they're all out there somewhere. I mean, invasion from outer space, and it's almost like the enemy, the new enemy, could be seen to be coming from over there, from beyond the Earth's atmosphere, you know, coming in to attack us. And it's only another step to saying, well, it's come from them, hasn't it? You know, let's make an enemy out of them, you know.
One of the roots into science fiction historically was the kind of invasion novels of the late 19th century, and they kind of overlap with people like H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds, and of course War of the Worlds has been filmed many, many times. Yeah, there's always been that element in science fiction of the fear of the other, the fear of the alien, the fear of the unknown. If you go back to the 1950s, again, time of the Cold War and the space race, obviously we get films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which can be read either as a critique of communism or as a critique of McCarthyism. Actually, it has many different meanings. It has many different uses. Just to say that there is a fear of the unknown or fear of the alien and science fiction is priming or so like that, it's not necessarily the case. Again, if you look at, say, American series like Battlestar Galactica, had a very interesting take upon the war on terror and a very kind of skeptical, critical, ambivalent attitude towards American foreign policy back in the decade. So we can't always say that science fiction is kind of priming us for these kind of things.
But they are creating the intellectual space for these things. They are creating the terminology, the concepts.
They can do that. That's one function.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for coming on Brave New World programme. Dr. Paul March-Russell, lecturer in comparative literature at the University of Kent and editor of the International Review of Science Fiction. It's been really interesting talking to you. And thank you for listeners for being with us. I think this is one of the best and most interesting Brave New World programs we've done for a long time. Thank you very much. Goodbye.